Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Revolution Radio. This is a special edition of Walls in Our Minds, and we're waiting for our host to come on. We're very pleased to have a two-hour show this evening, joined by a number of guests. And Terry, are you there yet?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, very good. I'm going to turn the show over to you.
I am hearing a second feed. And I'm not sure where that's coming from, whether somebody maybe has got a live mic and got the stream on in the background. That's a possibility.
Is your computer muted?
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm just going to proceed and hope that nobody else is hearing that, but I suspect everyone is hearing it.
No, well, I'm not hearing it.
Okay. That's odd. My stream is turned off. That's going to drive me crazy.
All right. Listen, why don't you just call back in?
I believe I'll do that. Red,
yes,
how about
I'm
you
on.
Open us with a prayer? How about you open us with a prayer while I'm calling back in?
Okay. Gracious Heavenly Father, we come to you knowing that we are helpless without you and your help to hold us up and give us the strength and the wisdom that we need to communicate with our fellow Americans. We pray now, dear Lord, that you would look down on us, have mercy on us. We made a lot of mistakes. We ask for forgiveness of the mistakes that we've made in the past, knowing that you hear when we make our confessions of errors and mistakes, you hear, and you're faithful and just to forgive us our sins. And we sure love you for it, and we appreciate it. And we just pray, dear Lord, that the program tonight would help people out there to become better informed and be better equipped to battle the evil forces that are besetting us, our country, that our country is being just inundated in that which is false, that which is nothing more than propaganda. And we pray that we would be able to sort it out, and when there's propaganda involved, that we would be able to identify it. We pray, dear Lord, that you would help us now, because we know that we are inadequate It is only with your help and your assistance that we can be of use to you and your kingdom. Now, we just thank you now for this privilege, and we pray that we have a good audience tonight and that they will go away after the program feeling that they have been blessed themselves. And I just thank you now for everything in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you very much, Red.
Did you get rid of the noise?
I did. And it was really strange, too, because I had to shut even my Outlook down before it went away. It was, but I've got a clear signal now, so whatever it was, I'm not sure what it was, but it's handled.
Let me say that I have my Rife machine going, and there is a little hum coming out of that, but I don't think that would do it. Those are radio waves, of course, but I have to double up. I always have to accomplish two or three things at once, and I'm shooting for three things tonight while we're on the show, and I didn't realize it was going to be 2 hours, but that's fine. We'll make out, and so I'm anxious to see what you've got for a program tonight, and as usual, I hope I can do mostly listening, so on your way.
Thank you, Red. I think we're going to have plenty to talk about tonight. Our first guest tonight is a gentleman that I met, and Kate and I met back in 2009 at the Continental Congress up in Illinois. And this is Mr. David Scheid. And David has been a hardworking patriot and fighting many battles on many fronts. He's a co-founder of the Sherman Institute. And David, welcome to Revolution Radio. You've been on here with us before, but I don't know that we've had you as our primary guest before, but you have been through quite a saga, and it is one of the clearest demonstrations of judicial tyranny I have ever seen in my life. So, David, how about you say hello and introduce yourself, give our listeners a little background, and maybe if you feel comfortable, just launch right out into kind of giving us an idea of this latest set of circumstances that's brought us to this point.
Well, thank you, Terry, and it's always good to hear your voice, and it's good to hear Red Beckman's voice again, and I thank you very much for having me on your show. I think this is a first for me, and I think you might have heard a little something about this saga a while back, probably in June, one way or another. And what had started out with, as a speeding ticket, probably a year or close to a year and a half ago, I went into challenge in a local Michigan court in Wayne County. And when I went in there, all I found was a complete robbing of not only my due process rights, but everybody else's that was in there. The notice of hearing that I had said that I was supposed to see a magistrate and a representative of the police officers, the police department. And when I went in there, the only person that I was confronted with was the police officer himself, dressed in plain clothes, working out of the prosecutor's office, impersonating a prosecutor and basically extorting money from everybody that he had waiting in the pew who had received any of these notices. And he was giving everybody the shakedown, saying that if they didn't pay what he was asking, that they were going to have to come back. And when the hearing notice said that we were supposed to have a judicial hearing that day, and so when I started questioning what he was doing, that there was no judicial action being available in response to this, that he threatened me with contempt of court, and it just only went downhill from there. And so When I got home, we didn't get anywhere on that, and he didn't get any money out of me and told me that I had to come back at some later time. And I looked at this hearing notice, and where it said the magistrate, it didn't have a name for the magistrate, but it had a P number, which is the bar, the Michigan State Bar number that attorneys and lawyers and judges have. So I looked up this bar number of this so-called magistrate that was supposed to be there but wasn't, and it came up with a missing. There was no such number registered with the state bar. So I'm looking at this hearing notice that was sent through in the mail, saying, well, you know, this is mail fraud. You know, they're representing to everybody that they're supposed to be seeing a magistrate and a representative of the police department, and all they're getting is the Joe that, and he was the one that wrote the ticket. So I started, that was the starting point of me actually challenging what was going on in this town and this township. And I tried getting a cross complaint. Of course, the police officer, I told him I was there to file a cross complaint, and he wouldn't allow me to do it. So I ended up having to file my cross complaint in a higher level court. And when I did, I tried to bring the speeding ticket from the district court up to the circuit court, and the circuit court judge refused to allow me to do it. So he wanted to make this, you know, more complicated from the get-go. Then I had court watchers in on the counterclaim. Seemed to go much faster than the lower court case of the original speeding ticket. And that case, I had court watchers in there, and just they were watching as this judge just at the circuit court level completely denied me my due process rights, besides allowing me to combine what makes the most sense is, you know, to have the speeding ticket along with the cross complaint all in one court. So he denied me due process rights, ended up dismissing my cross complaint. That thing just flew through the Court of Appeals and up to the Supreme Court. And in the process of doing that, you know, when you go to a higher level court and they deny you something, then there's always an open door. And I'm the kind of guy that takes the open door. And being that I've got about 8 or 9 years behind me here of having been wiped out of all of my financial resources and everything, I've been filing the last 4 years at least as a formal Paul Purvis litigant. And while I'm making ends meet and borrowing money to go to school, I'm at least able to show that I don't have anything, but I'm exercising my due process rights in the court. So when I get to the Court of Appeals, they're denying me now. They look at the kind of case that I've got. They're looking at some evidence that I've got, and you know, there was more evidence that had been developing at the lower court level on this judge, and as they were proceeding to move forward and denying me other due process rights with the original speeding ticket, and I was throwing that stuff into the higher level courts, and the Court of Appeals was denying my due process rights to even be in the court by denying my motion for waivers of fees. And so I ended up with four cases one speeding ticket got divided into two right away. When I was in the Court of Appeals, two more developed, and so we ended up with one. I ended up with one case in the Supreme Court, two pending in the Court of Appeals, and the original speeding ticket, once it was finally dismissed, it ended up going on appeal to the Wayne County Circuit Court. So four cases against the same judge, against the same police departments, and I was accusing them of criminal racketeering and corruption and felony offenses, malfeasance and obstruction of justice, and I was asking for a correction of the lower court record because I found out that the stuff that I had filed, you know, in trying to get the original speeding ticket resolved, there were other fraudulent notices that were sent out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They were doing what government does really well. And so with these four cases pending over this period of a year and a half, in June, I had a phone call from someone who lives in that very same township, and this guy called me up and he said he'd been harassed by the police. It's been going on for quite some time, and that the city inspectors were also giving him a hard time. They had written him a ticket for not getting a permit to build a fence in his backyard. And so he wanted to challenge this, and he was set up for an informal hearing in this same court with the same judge that I had in the Supreme Court. And so he was asking for some court watchers just to sit in the courtroom and just take notes on what was going on, and he wanted to give me a call along with several others. And when I went there, we all met. There was the person who was supposed to be at the informal hearing, and then there was five others of us that were kind of peppered around the courtroom. And over the course of about, I'd say, pretty close to an hour and a half, you know, we watched proceedings as they went along, and eventually, this long story short, the judge, when I got up to use the restroom and came back into the room, I noticed her head was following me as if she might have recognized me, and I don't doubt that she didn't, given the history of what I'd been going through with her for the previous year and a half. And so I sat down. About 15 minutes later, the guy whose hearing it was, he had not even been called yet for hearing. He got up, and he started heading for the back door to go use the restroom himself, and as soon as he stood up, this judge told her bailiffs to go get him and put him into the jury box. He was blown away, and what we had just seen not long before that is somebody who could not pay their bond, or somebody who couldn't pay their fine on a traffic citation or something like that. This person was put in the jury box until they could get the bailiffs in there to put them in handcuffs and take them away. And so it's when this guy gets up that we knew that to go use the restroom, she puts him into the jury box, and so I start writing immediately, you know, what's going on. And the next thing I know, and he's not sitting down, he's standing up. And so there's this thing, there's this commotion that's started by this strange action that has been started by this judge in the first place. And so the next thing I know, I hear this yelling, and I'm still trying to write what's going on. And the next thing I know, I'm seeing this bailiff standing in front of me with his hand on his gun telling me to stand up. And so I stand up, and I was probably standing for about a second and a half, and the next thing I hear was a shrieking yell to sit down. So I sat back down again. And it turned out that it was the judge that was yelling at the other guy in the jury box to sit down. But, you know, so there was this confusion that was created. And so then I start writing again what's going on, and this I get this nudge from one of the other court watchers that was sitting next to me, and I look up again, and it's the same bailiff. He's still got his hand on his gun, and he's screaming at me to stand up again. So when I stand up, they put me in handcuffs and took me out of the room, and they apparently had charged me with contempt of court. And I hadn't even opened my mouth, but I didn't know what the charge was. I didn't know anything that was going on other than I'm being taken away, likely because she did recognize me, and she was just getting her guys to take me away. And I ended up going to out of the county. People had come to try to as soon as she took me out of the room, they took me out of the room in handcuffs. This judge went forward to create terror in the rest of the courtroom, trying to find out how many others there were and what their names were. And we have affidavits from all five as to what happened with me, and that I didn't even open my mouth. I wasn't doing anything to do anything other than just sitting there like any other person has the right to do. And she wanted to get everybody's names after that, and if they didn't give them their name, then they were the same thing was going to happen to them. She just literally created terror in the courtroom on the people in the courtroom. So I ended up going the paperwork said I was going to a different county. When we got out there to that county, I was in shackles. Except they didn't take me to that one where the paperwork said. They said, you're going to a different one. So they take me to some other different place, and I'm going, oh, my God, nobody's going to know where I'm at. And so, you know, I had all my due process rights just stripped away from me, and I'm kind of getting an idea what the NDAA might look like. You know, when they just pluck you out of wherever you're at, they go take you wherever they want, and you know, c'est la vie. You don't know anything. They don't have to tell you anything. And so the only thing that they did check me into this other county jail, they told me that I was being charged with contempt and that I had a 30-day sentence. And I said, I'm a crime victim. And it goes on from there. But people were working on the outside from day one to try to deal with this situation, to file writs of habeas corpus in every multiple counties and at multiple levels of courts, at state court and federal court. And I was trying to find, and they went to the U.S. Attorney's Office on my behalf with crime report. I was trying to file crime reports from inside the jail. I did my own writ of habeas corpus from inside the jail, and nothing in 30 days' time, or 26 days when you get a little good behavior, in those 26 days' time, nothing worked. Absolutely nothing worked. And so what we've got right now is a situation, a recent situation, where we've got affidavits, sworn affidavits of witnesses to this judge acting way outside of her authority, outside of her jurisdiction. She also, we found out that she assigned the guy's civil ordinance violation on an informal hearing. She assigned that case number to my arrest and incarceration. We had people going there trying to get transcripts, trying to get a copy of the order to take on appeal, trying to get videotapes of the hearing, anything that we could possibly get. It was all denied. They even said that they wouldn't have had transcript because it was an informal hearing. Now, keep in mind, she hadn't even called the case yet because this guy was going to go to the bathroom. So they said that it was an informal hearing, so therefore it wasn't. There was no transcript being taken on it, but on the other side of the coin, they're saying that I was being charged with contempt. Well, you can't be in contempt of an informal hearing. You know, so it was contempt of court, but yet they're denying that there was any court hearing with transcripts. So it's they're using fraud, and they're using a double-edged sword here and color of law to continue this charade. How about that?
Amazing,
was that pretty concise?
That's an amazing story, David. Yes, it is. It was concise and it was very clear, and I appreciate the clarity. I just can't even imagine. I've witnessed, you know, judges who did not allow proper procedure. I've seen them not allow due process. I've seen them deny people's rights, but nothing quite as blatant and ridiculous and out of control as this is, simply because you didn't even enter into the arena You were just in the stands. And silent in the stands. I mean, you said nothing. You didn't do anything to disrupt anything. Yet,
correct.
You know, she went out of her way to incarcerate you, though you had done absolutely nothing. It's mind-boggling that these people are allowed to continue to sit on the bench. I mean, that judge belongs in jail. And Red has been saying for a long time that, you know, there's not a federal judge in this country that doesn't belong in jail, and I've certainly come to totally agree with him on that. But your case, what are you doing now? What's happened, you know, since you've gotten out? You know, have you had any success in filing anything on this? Do you see any means of getting any kind of recourse?
Well, you know, I'm in a quandary right now of trying to decide. It's a very clear case of 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, deprivation of rights under color of law. And, you know, I was wanting to get out of the court because I've been in the courts for so long, and I've gathered so much evidence of the corruption. And I can smell it, I can spot it, I can put my finger on it very easily anymore. And so I know that it's so corrupt that it's dysfunctional, and it's a broken machine, and it won't work anymore. And there's no sense in even wasting any more time in it. I want to start, and this will be a segue later into another aspect of the things that I'm doing. I want to use media, public access television, and the internet to put judges and these corporate government actors into the court of public opinion and show the evidence there, because there's evidence that doesn't ever get shown to a jury, because I can't get to a jury. And I can't get to a grand jury. I've been screaming for a grand jury for, you know, the better part of a decade, and I can't get access to a state or federal grand jury here in the state of Michigan. So I want to answer your question about what it is that I'm trying to do. I'm trying to decide whether I want to see if I can get a high-powered attorney who specializes in civil rights laws and has a big reputation and it would be interested in this case, or whether I should start working with my local assembly members and the patriot groups and the people who have done their research coming together and deciding what course of action that we'd like to take, and use my case as a battering ram for the I won't say pro se litigant, but I'll say somebody who's acting under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and resting solely on that, and starting with the judge's oath of office, which I have since gotten. So I'm kind of taking one step at a time, and I'm looking at the options, and knowing I got time, but wanting to do something, and that's where I'm going right now.
Well, I'd like to ask my co-host, Dr. Cade and Red, to chime in with your thoughts on this, because this is mind-boggling. And we had Trish Krause and David Lonier and Dwayne Moore.
Yes.
And Dwayne on live, by the way. But we had them on right when this happened, and we put the word out on it. But, it's been some time has passed since then, and the fact that they held you for 30 days, to me, they owe you for that time.
Well, that's right. And there was somebody that sent me which, by the way, Trish Krause, I believe, she knows about this call, and she, I think, was going to be trying to be on the line. So if you see a 734 area code, that could be her number calling in. What were you saying there?
I wanted to hear from Red and Kate on this to get their
okay.
their thoughts on this.
Well, I'd like to get some feedback on this too, because I'm starting to lean towards wanting to do something on my own and not trusting an attorney, no matter how high powered he might be, he or she. I'm more inclined to want to do this myself and work with you know, something of a task force of people that can do some research and come up with what we need for a 42 USC Section 1983 case.
Well, obviously, if you bring an attorney in, there's no way to set a common law court. And I'm sure
right.
Red's going to have some ideas on this. But, Red, if you're talking, you must be muted. We're not hearing you, but I'd like to hear from you, Red, if you're...
Yeah, I just turned off, hit my mute off button. You can hear me now?
Sure can.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a similarity with another case that I got involved in. It was a phony traffic thing. This fellow was traveling in a different state than his home state. And he was coming into a city, and he saw a traffic stop ahead of him. So he didn't like the smell of the thing, and so he just drove into a business and parked in their parking lot. And when he did that, he had the city cops were just down on him right now. And they were just outrageous, and they, and of course he was, you know, somewhat informed in the freedom movement and such, and so he held his own pretty well. But they had to bully, and so they, and of course what it was, you know, these municipalities are having trouble paying their bills and everything, and. Since the economy has gone in the toilet, and they are doubling and tripling fines and such, and trying to collect more money, and so the cops are you know, they're out collecting money for the city. Anyway, they put him in jail, and it took a $750 cash bond to get him out. And he was fighting them on his own, and for 6 months. They were in and out for hearings and this and that, and they denied everything, the city traffic court judge. And they had him pretty well backed into a corner after about 6 months. And somebody told him he should call me, and he did. And so he told me the story, what had happened, and I said, you go to the, and this is just a suggestion, I'm not an attorney, but
I
think,
okay.
I told him, I said, you should just go to the closest federal court and file a Title 42 under Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Okay.
That secures your right to a Seventh Amendment common law jury. And so he did that. He grasped what I was trying. Of course, he was desperate. He was grabbing at any kind of a straw that floated by. And so he did that. He filed the action in federal court, and I told him, I said, don't go after the prosecutor, just name the city traffic judge, because you may want to call that prosecutor, subpoena him as a witness. And if you name him in the complaint, that might be a little difficult.
That
so,
sounds good, yeah.
Anyway, he went through this, and... when the judge, the municipal court judge, when he got his summons, he immediately, on his own motion, dismissed the entire action, dismissed the case. He instructed the city prosecutor to write him a letter, the plaintiff, in the federal action, and apologize on behalf of the city and the judge and all, and because they seen what was coming. Now, I had explained to him how that when you file that Title 42, have we got some competition or what?
I'm sorry, I think that might be Trish. That sounds a little like her voice there.
Trish raised her hand, and Kate gave her a live mic, and when you got a live mic, you either have to mute your own phone or stay silent.
How do I do that? Pound six?
No, it would be the mute button on your phone, Trish. Go ahead, Red.
I'm on it.
Anyway, when you sue somebody like that, the first thing that happens, the defendant, they have to notify the liability insurance company that the municipality has the contract with for their liability insurance.
Yes, yes, yes.
From that point on, the city attorney, the city traffic judge, and all, they have nothing to do with that case. They've just got to stand by and let the insurance company attorneys handle the case. Now you're in an entirely different ballpark because the attorneys for the insurance company, they don't care really how much they have to pay out for the damages that they caused, that was caused by the ineptitude and whatnot of the city cops and the corruption. Because the insurance company, they just raised the premiums for the city to pay to get their money back. And I have not heard what he has collected, but he had blood in his eye, boy. He was out to get him. He's fair across on the East Coast, and I'm on the West, he was going after him. And the last I heard, he was collecting from, you see, you can file, when you file the one, and then you can file another one. And the city attorney admitted that the complaint or the ticket that the cops had filed was not proper. It was, they had Mickey Moused it, and they just thought they were going to blackmail this guy and make him contribute to the city coffers. And it didn't work that way. And so he was going for the maximum. And this will usually work. I had a lengthy conversation with I think he's the most outstanding scholar in America, studying our history and especially the legal history and the legal system in our country. I had talked to him a couple of 3 months ago, I don't remember exactly when, and I explained about the 7th article of the Bill of Rights and what it was really all about, and I asked him, he hadn't really got into it.
Now, who was that?
But I told him, I said, I would really like to have you analyze this and come up with some information that would help people on this. And I had a lengthy conversation with him this morning, and he said, you're right. He said, every judge in this country, I don't care if he's a traffic court judge in a little podunk town of 1,000 people or 2,000 people, and all the way to the 9 justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. every single one of them are tax consumers. Am I correct?
Tax consumers.
They are beneficiaries of the tax laws, and not only that, but judges in most states, a percentage of the fines that they levy against people goes into their retirement fund.
I've heard that. Mm-hmm.
So, what you have, you see, the Seventh Amendment, or the Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights was put there. The founders understood this principle that all of these judges all have a conflict of interest. Now, when you read the Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights, it says, in suits at common law, if the value in controversy exceeds $20,
you're entitled to a jury.
And, mm-hmm. and the bankers and the politicians trap themselves, because $20, when the Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights was put on there, $20 was a lot more money than it is today, right?
Right.
And so today, it's still $20. So you can come by $20 much easier today than you could back there 200 years ago. And it's kind of a humorous thing with me to think how that they inflated the money, and once in a while they get trapped in their own mischief. But anyway, this fellow that I talked to this morning had never really dealt with the conflict of interest. In the area, I mean, like I was doing, where every single individual that calls himself a judge, or if he's in a position where he makes findings of fact or conclusions of law, if he is a government employee, he is a government agent.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, we have stopped the tax court in every case that I have had any opportunity to work with, simply because the tax court is a phony thing. It's not a court. There is no constitutional due process. The tax court judge makes all findings of fact and conclusions of law. And here he is. He's a party to the action because he is a government agent.
Yep.
He's got a conflict of interest. So if you get trapped into the tax court trap, you just get the petition the tax court, and then after the court has set a date for trial, accepted your petition, of course, and your complaint, and then before the trial, why, you put in a motion to dismiss, supported by, number one, a judicial notice. That judicial notice is you put the judge on notice of his conflict of interest and the fact that he cannot make findings of fact or conclusions of law. You
so
just
this is a motion to dismiss the judge then, right?
No. You dismiss the controversy, the whole thing, because there isn't a judge in the country. There isn't a one in the country that isn't a government agent. I'm talking about all nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court and on down. Now, you see, when you read the Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights, you discover that what we call the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., is not the highest court. They call them the Supreme Court, but they are not the highest court in the land. The Seventh Amendment common law jury, when they make a finding of facts, their decision in that Seventh Amendment jury trial cannot be reexamined by any court in the land. What does that tell you? Now, you hear all about the sovereignty. issue. If you had brought up sovereignty to a state legislature 5-6 years ago, they'd have laughed you out of town. Now, every state out there, their state legislatures are talking about sovereignty, the state sovereignty over the federal government.
Right, right. I know that's a hot issue right now.
It's a big issue. And this is where, you know, back in the 80s, there was a group in California, a patriot group, that they made a big issue out of the sovereignty, and they contacted me and wanted me to join with them. And I said, well, wait a minute. I said, how do you confirm? Where do you get this, this sovereignty? Where do you exercise it? Sovereignty is something that is only good if you exercise it.
Yeah. You know,
they said, all we have to do is claim sovereignty. And I said, no, that won't work. You've got to understand, and I told them at that time that it was the 7th article of the Bill of Rights. At that time, stuff like this comes hard because the attorneys in the law schools in this country don't teach the student lawyers anything about the 7th article of the Bill of Rights. Because when you go to a common law court, an attorney cannot come in and speak for you. You have to speak for yourself.
Cool. I've gotten about 8 years of experience in doing that now, so it's
better. Yeah, if you get an attorney, the judge will automatically shift everything into equity or admiralty jurisdiction, and he can do anything he wants, and you can't touch him. But if he gets out of line on that 7th Amendment, and I sued a federal judge, the senior federal judge in the state of Montana. I sued him in 1993 because I had filed at least 3 actions against the Internal Revenue Service in federal court and demanded a jury trial on each and every case. And he, on motion from the Justice Department, had just summarily thrown me out of court without a hearing even. And so I sued him, Title 18, 241, 242. Those are a couple of my favorite statutes.
I know that's the criminal aspect of the color of law and conspiracy.
Right. Yep. Mm-hmm. Right. And I filed the action against the federal judge, and I, along the cover sheet, I'm not an attorney, and so I don't do things. I just don't do things like I have to update every once in a while because I find out I've made some mistakes. But I've been able to get away with it, I guess, to a certain extent. But anyway, on your cover sheet on your complaint, you've got that column that goes from the top pretty much to the bottom of the page, and all they put up there is the judge's name and the case number.
Right.
And below where that goes in that column, I put all facts to be tried by 7th Amendment common law jury trial. And it was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court in August of 96. In December of 96, the Solicitor General noticed all the parties to the action that he was not going to oppose me. In other words, he admitted that I was 100% correct. And
say that one more time, will you, Red? All facts to be what?
By
the 7th Amendment.
I made a mistake then. I made a mistake, but I got away with it, see?
Uh-huh.
Now I would put down all facts to be tried by a common law jury as per the 7th article of the Bill of Rights. That's the way I would do it today, rather than call it the 7th Amendment.
Seventh article of the Bill of Rights. Okay.
Yeah. And
all right.
What I did, I wove that concept of the common law jury and the fact that the judge was making findings of fact and conclusions of law in those other actions when he summarily dismissed my actions and threw me out of court. He was making these findings of facts and everything, and here he is. He's a party to the action because he is part of the federal government.
Okay, yep.
He's a party to it. He can't make findings of fact or conclusions of law. It has to be the sovereigns. You see, in the old days, in history, you'd have a monarchy or something, and there'd be a controversy develop at the lower levels with the government administrators and the citizens, and it would work its way up through the system. And if the guy was fortunate, he might be able to go up through all of the government courts and still be able to demand that the sovereign, the king, would get that problem on his desk. And when he made his decision, that was it. That was the final stop.
Mm-hmm.
This is what the jury is. The common law jury is the kings and queens
system. Would that be considered an Article III court? Because I'm hearing that too. That we don't get a regular court, even if you take it to the U.S. Supreme Court. You ask for the Article III. So help me get into that because I want to.
I wouldn't say anything about Article III or anything else. I don't think I'd
okay.
do that. I didn't do that when I sued the judge. Now that
okay.
case that I when I sued the judge, that has been docketed. It is still docketed yet today, and they are never going to hear that.
Gosh.
They're not going to hear it. I'll tell you. Those judges are scared to death of this seventh article of the Bill of Rights because it cuts them right down to size. And I tell people, a judge would rather you call him an SOB than call him a government agent.
Well, I've already been putting that in writing. I've figured out that these are agents. They're also actors. They're government actors, and because they aren't really the government, and they're just acting like it under cover of law.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't go into much of these legal terms like color of law and all that. I wouldn't go into that at all.
Okay.
You see. From my experience, you're better off just going in there like a redneck and talking just good old, honest. You're a man. You're a person of integrity and such. And you measure your words well as best you can. And don't start talking lawyer talk. Don't do that. That's not necessary. Now, I had another case in federal court. It was a quiet title action. The IRS had put a lien on and seizure. They put a lien and a seizure on in the same day, which is not proper. But anyway, I at that time I was traveling constantly. Speaking at all kinds of functions and such, and I had to get an attorney. I gave him, he was a somewhat of a friend, one of the better trial lawyers in Montana, and I took him the paperwork and everything and told him what I wanted, and he said, Red, you can't win. And I said, oh, yes, I can. And I said, I don't care. You're going to get your money. You're going to get paid, and you've already been paid. I had used him before for some things, and I said, You file this quiet title action in federal court, and we'll see what happens. Well, I finally got him talked into it, and it took a couple of 3 or 4 months to get before I got, finally got him to file it. Well, it laid there. That suit, suing the judge, was going up through the district and the appellate level, and the appellate level, the Ninth Circuit is the most corrupt in the nation, of course, and I had to go through the Ninth. And they more or less told me right off the bat that that case against the federal judge belonged in the U.S. Supreme Court. They didn't want to touch it. And so, anyway, you see, the system, there isn't a judge, there isn't an attorney out there that doesn't know that the system is broken. But they keep trying to patch it up until they can get their pension and that type of thing.
And well, so I've been going round and round with an attorney that that has done a lot of favors for me, and he's now to the point. I just talked to him today. He's looking like he's preparing for retirement now. He's cutting back on a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and well, the more he heads that direction, the more he's starting to admit that I'm right about a few things.
Yeah, well, you see what happened there with that quiet title action. The Justice Department and such, they were just kind of holding fire because of the suit I had against the federal judge. They were both in there at the same time. And only the one is handled by an attorney, and the other one I'm in there on my own. And so when the case was docketed with the against the federal judge, when it was docketed with the Supreme Court, the lawyer, my lawyer Rob, he got a phone call from the district counsel, IRS district counsel. And the district counsel says, Rob, we've got to settle this case. Well, this was just out of the clear blue sky, and Rob is, he's wondering what's going on. So he asked the guy, what's this all about? And the attorney, the district counsel for the IRS said, we have a very bad precedent coming up. And we settled that. I got $145,000 out of them. And, of course, it was my money. I got the money, and I joke about it. The check didn't bounce. I just put it to work and made some more money. And
I'm hoping, there was and Trish is on the line here. I'd like, if at all possible, for her to share some of the things that she did on my behalf. She was working with somebody from Detroit, and along with Dave Lonier that you had. These people had gone to multiple counties. I mean, Trish started with the Redford Township had kidnapped me to begin with, trying to get documents from the court, anything that would provide any kind of evidence of even what I was being charged with, because I didn't have any clue. I asked inside the jail who was my accuser, who is. Who's the harm party, what am I being charged with, and this kind of stuff. And what I got back from the jailers, the sheriff's department, was completely fraudulent. I mean, they supposedly did his research to get these answers and came back in writing with stuff that was telling me that my accusers were a completely different county. and things like this, and that I was being charged with criminal contempt. You know, I had no due process. There was no prosecutor involved. He told me that there was a file with the prosecutor in Wayne County, et cetera, et cetera. But Trish had gone to that court, had gone to two other counties, had gone to federal court, so many of these things. And if she might get a few minutes there, she might have shared some of that with you already. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, back in the 70s and 80s, we did a lot of that kind of thing. We had one situation once where this truck driver, he was totally ignorant of the law and everything else, and he was having some IRS problems, and we tried to help him. We spent most of a night getting ready for a hearing, and he kind of stumbled around in the courtroom when we had the hearing, but there was no attorney available. And the judge, he had to bend over backwards. He had no choice. He had to bend over backwards to kind of... And they did. When they dismissed or recessed, we were out in the lobby. Oh, there was a dozen of us at least, and we were just, chattering away and amazed at what had happened. And the prosecutor, a lady, and she was a lady. I'll grant you that she was a very nice person and all of that. And we're just busy talking about all of this. And she came out of the U.S. Attorney's office and came down the hall where we were into the lobby. And she walked right into the group and up to this fellow that had just had the hearing. And she told him, she said, if at any time you believe that your constitutionally secured rights are being threatened or abused or violated, you come and see me.
Oh,
we were blown away. We were blown away.
David?
Well, my whole criminal complaint was blown away. Trish had, I think, turned it into the U.S. Attorney's Office. Didn't you, Trish?
Trish, you have a live mic. Why don't you introduce
Trish?
Yes, I
did. Yes, I did.
Trish has been somebody that I have been working with in the Patriot Movement here. She's been the legislative liaison for the Campaigns for Liberty.
And We the People.
And We the People.
We distributed the Articles of Freedom to all of the representatives, state.
I wish we had a few million of them just like her.
As moving forward with what's happened to Dave Scheid, we filed papers with the Michigan Supreme Court last Monday, and that was to ask for an extension of time on the two Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals cases that are ready to go to the Supreme Court. But due to the interference of Judge Khalil in Redford Township, because the cases are against them specifically, not to mention the U.S. District Court judge that was assigned to his U.S. District Court writ that I filed. And she refused to recuse herself to go on to that. Because now, and immediately following the submissions to the U.S. Supreme Court, these Sixth Circuit Court of Appeal cases that he worked on as soon as he got out to submit them, they were immediately rejected that day, most certainly stamped the following day.
Let me clarify that. That was the Michigan Court of Appeals. I had
correct.
Two cases that were pending there, and I tried to get them an extension, a motion to extend time to get
okay.
them in there because my time expired when I was in jail. And what Trish was saying was that they retaliated. They not only dismissed those two, my motion to extend time to get rid of those two cases that I wanted to bring to the Supreme Court, they also dismissed the case that I had against that judge that was pending in the Supreme Court, along with two other cases that I had, or one other case that I had in the.
It's immediately following that Friday that he was released. When he was released on the 2nd of July, on that Friday, I was at the 11th hour out front of the U.S. District Court case just screaming at them on the phone, demanding to talk to the chief presiding judge that's in that building right now. I plan on driving there to pick him up so he doesn't have to be suffering two more or three more days of what they've already inflicted on him now just to jam it in their face what they're doing is wrong. The following day, that judge that was assigned to the U.S. District Court case that I filed in Bay County that brought back to Wayne County, okay, that judge was listed on one of these cases that we had just resubmitted, right, Dave?
Yeah.
And then
I had
an immediate refusal that following Monday. It was the day that he was released is the day that she dismissed it. It was prejudice.
Yeah, it was, and this was the judge that I had in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals filed a judicial misconduct complaint that has been pending for 3 years. These judges aren't doing anything to do any self-policing, and they aren't recusing themselves when they need to be because this judge knew who I was and denied. Writ of habeas corpus, and actually it was after I got out. But Trish had filed in a county court,
Kim Worthy, and she's listed on one of your cases too,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Where I was going with that was that when you filed in the Midland County, where I was in the Midland County Jail. Early on, I think it was the next week after I had been jailed, a writ of habeas corpus was filed in that county to try to get the judge to get me out of there. Well, the judge denied the writ of habeas corpus and then set a date for the show cause order of why are you denying it, set the date 6 weeks ahead, which was a time that it was totally moot because I would have already been out.
And combined it with another writ of habeas corpus that had a totally different case number. They were going to hear them simultaneously. They charged me $150 to file that writ of habeas corpus in Midland County Court with Judge Beal.
When they weren't supposed to charge any more than how much?
Pardon?
They weren't supposed to charge how much? Or they couldn't charge any more than how much?
I called the Michigan Supreme Court Administrative Office, and I'm like, hang on a second. We've got a problem. This is what the U.S. District Court charged me, $5. I was told $15. They charged me $150. And then she says, who told you $15? I'm like, I don't know. I said, I haven't found writs all over the state. For nothing. Anyways, so they had me call Midland, so I called Midland Region of the Supreme Court Administrative Office branch there, and they shook down Lauterbach, the chief judge in Midland County, and he said, because they said it was filed as a motion, and he said, no, it was a writ, so that's a brownie point for us. Also, they have to refund that $150 because the writ of habeas corpus is free. So that's a double bogey. We already got on them. So
they were denied. They're doing that stuff. I'm inside the jail, and I wrote my own writ of habeas corpus because I did get some mail in there. And by the way, they stuck me in solitary confinement for the first 9 or 10 days that I was there because I was asking too many questions about a medical contract that they set in front of me upon check-in. They hand me this contract that's basically saying that they want me to initial here in that paragraph, initial the next one, sign the bottom, and if I refuse to sign anything, then sign there. And so I'm looking at this, and it's a clear contract. They want They want to be able to have carte blanche to do anything they want with me medically, and then another paragraph says that I have to pay for it. They can bill me for all this stuff later. So I start asking some questions, and the jailers, the sheriff's department is telling me that this they can't answer the questions because there's a third-party contractor that does the medical. But I don't see any name of the contracting company, of this medical contracting company on the contract. And believe it or not, I went into solitary confinement and all this stuff, for, you know, I spent the entire 3.5 weeks asking for the name of this medical contractor. And believe it or not, I got out of there in 3.5 weeks later, and I still don't have it. Still don't know the name of these medical contractors that are given everybody. Everybody's being mandated to sign a contract. They said 99.9% of the people don't ever give us this kind of problem. They just sign the thing, and I'm saying, well,
also,
you know,
when you sign for that, that is your consent, because you didn't consent in the courtroom, you didn't consent in that one room, you didn't consent when you were in the jail, you did not consent when you were taken to Clinton County. You never stepped foot
That's
in
right.
there, right? You were taken there in their van, and then taken to Midland and dropped off. So,
and from that, you know, I was constant. And while I was there, I did get mail, and Trish sent me what she had filed as the first writ in the Midland County where I was at the court there. So I took that information and I wrote my own writ of habeas corpus in about 8 pages. I had an equally lengthy formalized crime report where I'm reporting being the crime victim of this judge, and so the next thing I did is finally at that point they have put me into the general population. I've already done my time in solitary confinement. They figure that I'm not a harm to anybody. So they put me in the general population. And within that week that I'm in there, I had written this writ, and I had my crime report, and I took it to the jailers, and I said, I want to see a prosecutor. I want to see a judge. I want out of here, and I want out here now. I'm a crime victim. And I even followed their rules by putting their little cover sheet on it that's a request form, and they brought this thing back saying if I want to serve it to the sheriff that I need to mail it out. You know, well, I don't have the funding to do all that stuff, and I'm certainly not going to have the time element that's needed. I want it out now, and so. I put a grievance, so then I take it to the next level. Well, see, they provide you with the due process, but then they punish you for doing it. And so they gave me a grievance form, and I put the grievance form on top of it, and I said, look, here I have something from one of your other jailers from a few days ago that tells me that I'm being here on criminal contempt, that I've got a prosecutor with a file, that the accuser is in a different county, it's a circuit court of a different county altogether, and you know, this and that and this and that. So, you know, here I disagree with all this stuff. I want to see a prosecutor and I want to see a judge. And what did they do? Put me back in solitary confinement again. And that's where I stayed until I got out. And I go ahead. I could go on.
Well, we've got Aaron Bollinger on live with us too, so I'm going to let you introduce him in a minute, and I'd like for you guys to together give us an update on what's going on with the Sherman Institute. But before you go there, I'd kind of like to know what your game plan is at this point. Is what Red threw out at you sound inviting, or what are you going to do at this point?
It certainly did. It certainly did. The research that I've been doing and I'll just say in the sovereignty area, is hinting to that too. The demand for jury using the Seventh I heard the seventh article of the Bill of Rights, focusing on that, staying out of admiralty law. You know, there was so many people for so long were saying, well, you got to know this UCC code, you got to do this, you got to do that. Yeah, you study this stuff, take some salt, throw it over your left shoulder, turn it, do a little dance, and if you do that right, you're gonna get something out of it. Well, I don't buy all that old stuff anymore.
Well,
and when I'm saying it, the simpler the better. Just go with the Constitution,
we're also
Bill of Rights.
We are going to do the research, and we're going to find a good attorney that's going to represent this within the de facto and go after damages and what they've done, because it's pretty clear. And when we take it all and drive it all home, it's going to cause this judicial system to tremble.
Well,
we
and
caused
let me
a
ask
lot
this
of
Red.
Trouble in the state.
Let me ask this of Red, because I think I heard him say filing another case. I started to write it down. It was towards the beginning of your conversation. You were talking about. Do you think that there's they may try to do the Red Judicata kind of thing, but filing one in going after the judge individually, and then one for being out of authority and jurisdiction, and then one going against the court itself and doing that with an attorney or something.
Well, let me if Red is listening, Red, you might need to unmute yourself, but let me say this, David, and I hear you, Red, and I'll let you get in here. David, if you have an attorney, that means that you are in there as a corporate entity. Attorneys can only represent corporate entities. If you have an attorney, you cannot set a common law court. It's impossible.
The
only way to set a common law court is to go in there pro persona. You can't even go in pro se, because if you're representing yourself, you're still a corporate entity. You have to go in there pro persona. Correct, Red?
Yeah, that isn't as critical. Don't go in pro se. But, you can go in pro per, and I think you're probably pretty safe. I'll tell you, when they get confronted with the seventh article of the Bill of Rights, you see, they didn't get any big lessons in law school about the seventh, because for over 200 years, the legal profession has tried to bury. They've tried to ignore the seventh, hoping that it would go away, because the common law courts now. I don't know what the percentage is, but there's a lot of cases, a lot of controversies out there between citizens and different agencies of government. It doesn't make any difference if it's FDA, ICC, or what other alphabet agency there is. It doesn't make any difference. They're all involved in this, and so... if you've got a good handle on the seventh, you're in a position where you can lead rather than follow. And I think you'll probably get a confession out of them when they start saying, well, we don't know anything about seventh article courts. But don't forget, Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure,
that
provides for a Seventh Amendment common law jury. And I haven't had a chance to try this out, but I'm not going to, I don't anticipate having any kind of a problem.
Let me ask you something, Red. Trish did file a writ of habeas corpus in the federal court in Detroit, the Eastern District of Michigan. Mm-hmm. That case was denied. It was dismissed altogether. Now, just day before yesterday I filed just a notice of a claim of appeal to that. And mm-hmm. so I'm wondering now, can I take that appeal and just take it to this? Because the higher I go, I think, you know, I might as well go with the higher judges first if I can. And could I go to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals now on my own with the seventh article and do it right there in the Sixth Circuit instead of starting at the district level, because I've already got a case started, it's already got a case number, and I just take it to the next higher level now that way?
Let me say this. Now, what I'm going to say here, I'm just thinking out loud.
Uh-huh.
Because, you see, if you are using the seventh article of the Bill of Rights, you don't have any appeal. You see, there's no the facts tried by that Seventh Amendment common law jury are not to be reexamined by any court in the land.
Okay. This would be a first.
But listen, wait a minute. I think, I'm just thinking out loud here. What I think would probably work is if you ask the appellate court to send the controversy back down to the lower level, whatever level. I don't know how your court systems are set up in your state.
Yeah.
But ask them to order the case returned and give instructions to the lower court in how to perform, you see.
Because, ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah, you can't go, well, you see, you're giving the appellate court an opportunity to be intelligent people and do something that is, you know, just makes sense. Now, like I say, I'm just thinking out loud because I hadn't really gotten into this because I have not had, when I sued the judge, of course, you see, the district court, they, you know, I knew that what they would say, you know, denied, you see, even when I put the judge on notice. And, of course, in my situation here, the judge I sued in 93 has gone on to the higher court, and he's had to face the highest judge in the universe. And the judge that denied my, closed the door on me in the district court, he has gone on too. And so, they're out of my sights at this point.
Right.
There's just good old common sense. And like I said earlier, you want to keep this in mind because, you see, we are the nice guys. Back about 1983, I went up to the U.S. Attorney's Office there in Montana and told the U.S. Attorney that I was inviting him to lunch someday. I wanted to take him out for lunch. And it kind of took him by surprise, of course. But I told him, I said, anytime in the next couple of weeks, if you have a lunchtime that we can do this, why, you give me a call, have your receptionist give me a call, and I'll meet you here, and we'll go and have lunch someplace. Well, we did that. And when we went into an old style cafe where the booths were pretty private, you had a wall behind you sitting in the booth, while you had a wall that went clear to the ceiling. It was an old timer, and we had quite a lengthy, an interesting conversation as we walked from the courthouse the three or four blocks to this restaurant. And when we got into the booth, the first thing he said was, he said, "I don't know what it is," but he said, "even your detractors speak highly of you." Now, I'm bragging here. I'll have to admit that I'm bragging. But, you see, they deal in the court system with a lot of what some people would call riffraff.
Yeah, yeah.
The druggies and the child molesters and all this kind of thing. We're the nice guys. We're the ones that are trying our best to bring our republic back, bring our lawful government back. And I'll tell you, when I've talked to attorneys about this common law court and all, initially, why they kind of, they're kind of standoffish and everything is, why should a lawyer, a trained lawyer, talk, this kind of stuff with a layman? But as you explain it, they start getting intrigued by it because, like I told you earlier, there isn't a one in the whole gang that doesn't know our system is broken.
Yep.
And you can tell them this. Say, hey, you're going to have to be honest. You're going to have, if you've got any integrity, you're going to have to agree with me that the system is broken.
Yep.
And we're the nice guys. We're not the druggies and all of that. We're trying to make some changes for the better.
Well,
and
speaking
we
of changes,
would sure like to have them work with us.
Yep. And that would be a good segue here, Terry, to introduce Aaron and Dave Irons, too, if he's on the line. He's got a 517 number, if you can identify it. Dave is, and Aaron are both my co-founders at the Sherman Institute, and Aaron has been just an amazing asset in putting together these different programs and course syllabi and we've got if he's on the line, I'd like maybe he could even start with the judicial type programs dealing with the laws and some of the ideas that he's come up with and people that he's been bringing in and interviewing and things like this. Aaron, are you there?
I'm with you.
Aaron is here, and so is Dave Irons.
Wonderful. Well, we're all working hard. I'm kind of the technology. I will not say guru, but because I don't know technology that well. I'm having to kind of learn this stuff on the fly. But we've got me working with the technology, and Dave working with the business end, and Aaron working with many other people on the curriculum development and just the interviewing instructors and things like this and doing the marketing, artwork, just all kinds of stuff. So maybe Aaron can start out and just kind of tell us everybody what's new.
Let's get a clear definition of what the Sherman Institute is.
Well,
Aaron, you want to take that?
Listeners don't know.
I was approached by Mr. Scheiden Irons about, going on 2 years ago now with the basic notion of what's wrong with academia and how can we fix it. Well, it's pretty obvious. I mean, the whole system is broken down to the point that they pretty much are driven by Washington. And, of course, even Thomas Jefferson said 200 years ago, if we're directed by Washington when to reap and when to sow, we'll soon want bread. Well, if you put that in the academic realm, if we're directed by Washington what to teach and how to teach it, everybody's soon going to be pretty stupid. So this is what we're up against. And I had thought 20 years ago. Wouldn't it be great if some of what I had learned when I was working in Washington as a lobbyist could be applied over in maybe a couple of local community colleges, and I could just teach a few continuing ed courses or something on activism or whatever. But as I discovered, once you approach any of these people, you better be part of their system. You better be married to it, glued to it, and have friends and allies and associates all over it, or you're not going to get anywhere with these people. I couldn't even get in the door as a continuing ed instructor because I just wasn't playing their games the way they wanted them played. So when this opportunity presented, I told Mr. Scheid, well, I've been thinking about this for 20 years. Let's do it. And I started talking to other people that I had been involved with over the years, and we're heading toward our fall semester now, which will be the third official semester that this Sherman Institute has been open. And just in four-credit, three-credit-hour courses for fall semester, we have 20 on the calendar.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, if you haven't seen the fall semester yet, go to shermaninstitute.org and look over there at the top of the left-hand column for the upcoming fall semester, which starts the week of September 3rd, and you will see that collection of courses. Now, of course, there's other folks out there doing this, and I've been talking to a number of them, and Dave Irons has been coming through with ideas, and how do we market this, and how do we get the word out, and how do we bring in some of the celebrity instructors, you know, the kind of people that everybody would already know them and want to come in. But we've all found a couple of things to be true. First of all, can I
just interject something here, Aaron?
Yeah.
Because I think that while we were, you talked about an alternative to the education, you did not mention the mission statement of and the theological aspect of this, you know, if you can get a little bit more into the actual mission before telling, you know, what's new on it.
Okay, well, our big broad mission is to provide the kind of education that people would have gotten had they attended Yale in 1745 or, you know, any of our early founding schools. First of all, to get in the door at Yale in 1745, you had to be able to read and write and speak Greek, Latin, and Hebrew, all three. You couldn't get in the door if you couldn't already do that. Now, how many high school students today could pass Yale's entrance requirements? Obviously, if we made our standards that stringent, we'd never have anybody in. But how about from the reverse concept? By the time you graduate, you will be, you know, proficient in those biblical languages, so you can, you know, work with the New Testament in Greek or work with the Old Testament in Hebrew and understand a lot of the documents that are out there in the realm of law where you've got, you know, 15,000 Latin maxims thrown at you by courtroom people and all of that kind of stuff. So we now have Scott Spidell on board as an instructor, and he is proficient in both Greek and Latin. We're rolling out the first Latin course this fall. We've got Sarah DeLynn, who actually studied Hebrew in Israel as a Hebrew instructor, and those courses will be starting in the winter semester. But beyond that, you know, our history courses are a tag team quad group of courses, world history, three of them, American history, one of them. And if you look at that document that floats around the internet every now and then, it's 1895, could you pass this U.S. history test? Well, just look at the jaywalking interviews he does with people who can't even tell you, you know, two things about any of our founding documents, and these are native-born Americans. The immigrants do better on those kind of jaywalking exercises than the native-born Americans do. Something terribly wrong there. So we've brought in some good people. We've got a person who's got their doctorate in rhetoric and composition that's our Dean of General Studies and going to be teaching most of our English courses. And if you look at the titles of some of them, you would normally probably be in your third year of law school, if there, when you've seen a course titled Bill Construction or code construction or bill drafting. And those are the kind of courses we're actually offering in second year at Sherman Institute. If you're coming into a bachelor's program, it's a 200-level course on statutory interpretation. We're raising the bar considerably. And in our theology program, if I went out and asked to find an instructor who could teach on the intertestamental period, who was an expert in that neighborhood, I'd probably look 5 years to find one. Believe it or not, we've found three people that have come to us that want to teach in that realm. It's just amazing the kind of folks that have discovered that we're here, frustrated with academia across the board. And at this point, we've got a student-to-teacher ratio that's unequaled. Right now, I think we have about five instructors for every student. We're hoping to change that a little bit, but I'm talking, if you want a quality education, you get one-on-one time with these instructors, and that is just something unheard of today. They want grants, they want numbers, they want student loans and kids to get into debt before they ever start into school. We're teaching the concept that the borrower is servant to the lender. Pay for things as you go. We will not touch a student loan application and help a student fill it out. However they get their money, if they really want to do that and the government would accept our name as the school to get the money, some of our instructors may perhaps take it, but I don't think that the federal government would even give it to us because we're not accredited, and as we've said before, we probably wouldn't want to be accredited by anybody that would want to accredit us, because with those kind of credentials comes all the regulations and restrictions and problems that have caused academia to be what it is today. So all that said, look at some of these course titles we've got coming out for fall. Sentence Analytics. This is being taught by Dr. Roof as a first-year course. It might sound basic and boring and all grammatical and all those things you forgot in eighth grade, but we actually use, for example, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18 of the Constitution as one of those sentences that we dissect. Modern political science teaches that that is the elastic clause that gives Congress the power to do anything. The other 17 clauses directly in front of it forgot. Well, that's ridiculous. It's two additional tests. That anything proposed or done by the federal government be both necessary and done in a proper way. Necessary and proper. Not or not in addition to. But you need to tear those sentences apart. And Dr. Roof says there isn't a properly written sentence that's ever been devised that I can't dissect. And when she did that one, it looks like a roadmap of Peely in South Carolina. But by the time you're done, you can figure out, okay, this is the direct object for this verb, and this is the participial phrase that connects back to the power of Congress. And it explains just exactly what these guys who were writing at a 23rd grade modern reading level were actually saying in the Constitution. Now take that kind of a course and then get into the 200-level bill drafting or other things, and you can see why people taking these courses could advance so quickly.
And maybe along those lines, we could have Dave Irons come in and kind of give a clue as to what he had in mind as a founder in wanting to, how this kind of information can be applied to people who are aspiring towards careers in public service. Dave?
Sure. The concept was, I ran for House of Representatives in 08, and in the process I came to know a number of the people that were either running for office or were already in office. And it's amazing how little those people know about their job. It's not surprising how easily these people are captured by the system when you understand that many of them came into office, they had a good talk and they had wonderful promises to make, but they thought that when they got into office, they'd get on-the-job training and they'd learn how to do their job as a legislator. And they're absolutely right. By golly, when you get into office, they're going to teach you how to be a legislator and what you can do and what you can't do. And you join the good old boys club. And I see that these people are captured by the system, way before they even get into office. So it seems to me that the Tea Party has been fairly successful at getting candidates into office, but what they haven't been very successful at doing was finding candidates who actually follow through with their promises when they do get into office. Again and again and again, the Tea Party has had candidates to get into office and made these wonderful promises and then done the exact opposite. Or they even fold at the slightest bit of resistance and decide to endorse the neocon who's running against them. We just can't have that. It seems to me that people do not have the skills necessary to do their job once they get into office.
Well, the problem being, of course, David, they went to the same schools we did, and they were never taught what parliamentary procedure is all about and how every legislator, whether he's the Speaker of the House or a freshman just elected, they all come in with the same power. The rules of procedure say that. Yet they grab these freshman legislators, take them into the room, the speaker talks down to them, well, until you've been here at least two sessions, you're not going to be introducing any bills. But these are the ones the party would like, and if you come on board as a co-sponsor with these, we'll make sure you work your way up the food chain. So they basically co-opt these guys. They pretend they have no powers. The guys coming in have never read the rule book, so they don't know themselves that there's a different point of view, and they do what they're told.
That's exactly what happens, and these people really don't know their own power. I just had a presentation with the Jackson Tea Party a few days ago, and that was a real great night. People were inspired. We had a few local politicians that were running for government. We had one of the local party bosses that tried to poo-poo everything I had to say, and the room sort of booed him down.
That's great.
One of the things that we are teaching at the Sherman Institute, which is, as far as I know, unique to any university, is government financing. And right now we have a bookkeeping system in which the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report is never taught. This is the holy grail of bookkeeping. This is the actual, it's the tax return for every government organizations. And the governor of Michigan, who, by the way, is a CPA. If anybody should be able to understand the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, it should be Governor Schneider. And he made the promise that he would produce the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, the CAFR, and do it in everyday language, and he was going to do that by the first of the year, before he even got into office. He's never come through with that. The last comment he made on the CAFR was that it was not written for understanding by ordinary human beings, and of course it's not. So it's going to require some training, some understanding to even get these terms out, and some data mining techniques to be able to understand government financing. How can an organization even function if they don't have a good set of books?
Well, and government accounting is completely different than corporate. If you look at the average CFO that decides to run for state legislature or executive office or whatever, he may have just like this guy, been trained in CPA to do corporate type stuff. Well, public stuff's different. It's a whole different, and finance is yet another realm. And very rare can you find a single individual who has training in both aspects, finance and accounting, or public accounting versus private accounting. And, you know, we have found some of those types of teachers to be working with us. What we're lacking right now is students. And, of course, I didn't know if I should mention this or not, but I think I will just for the giggle of it, and I'll try to keep it short. But we're over the target. We know we're over the target because the Southern Poverty Law Center sent a fake student in to pump me for information, then did a hit piece on us. I didn't even know this had happened. I still thought this person was a potential student till I got an email from Rolling Stone magazine wanting to know if they could do a media inquiry. So I'm like, Rolling Stone's interested in us? This is interesting. So I took the bait and called the lady who happened to be a political writer, and she said, well, there was a piece that appeared in a Southern Poverty Law Center article about Sherman Institute, and they said that, you know, because you had worked for Liberty Lobby in Washington, that you were anti-Semitic. And I laughed. I said, anti-Semitic? I consider myself an Israelite. I'd have to be against myself. That's ridiculous. Well, to Rolling Stone's credit, they actually printed that. They actually published that retort, as well as a couple of other comments that I rebutted some of what had been said. Now, had I thought about it, I might have said, Rolling Stone, good grief, I've been playing guitar since I've been five. I've toured with hair bands in the 80s, and I'm even teaching a course on audio science to help, you know, people who might want to set up a PA to run a political rally learn how to use a PA system. And that would have been of interest to Rolling Stone readers. Instead, they was more interested in anti-Semitism and this, that, and the other nonsense than what we're really doing here. But it's kind of funny because to me, that shows, number one, we must be doing something right if SPLC is coming out against us. And number two, even Rolling Stone's picking it up. And that's probably the best press we could have got. And I didn't even reach for it. It came to us. At least in some ways. Now, you know, no press is bad press in one way, but it was the Southern Poverty piece particularly was definitely slanderous. I mean, it just was. But I'm not going to waste my time on that. They would love it if we stopped, you know, producing courses and doing what we're doing and got into some kind of contest with them. I have no interest in them whatsoever. We're going to keep doing what we're doing and, you know, address things as they come. We've got some really good instructors working with us, teaching all kinds of great materials, and more good people coming on, and more programs being developed all the time. So, you know, helping us get the word out. In fact, I sent an email over to Red. One of the courses that I just built is a contemporary theological literature course that can cross over between an English literature requirement and for a theology program. But I'd like Red Beckman's The Church Deceived to be one of the six books read in this 300-level course, so we need to be able to get a hold of that book and other things of this nature. I mean, we've got good people in our Patriot community, good potential instructors, people who have written tomes of good material. We could use the, you know, the law that never was as part of our tax program. I mean, I see no reason why not. That's excellent research, and it's right there at our fingertips. So make sure the stuff's available when our students start needing it. And
Well, Aaron has been doing a wonderful job of that. He's been finding resources. Everything from the world books, what was it, the great books?
Oh, we're using the great books of the Western world as one of the cores of our curricula because, you know, if you want to study who the greatest rhetoricians were, Aristotle and Plato come right to mind, and you can pick up the great books on eBay auctions for $150. And out of the great books program, you know, Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, you know, you want world history, it's right there. In fact, you can build two courses out of Gibbon without trying too hard. and all of those things that are right there at your fingertips. You can get 25 courses or 75 credit hours out of one single $150 textbook investment. No college does that today. They don't want that. They want to sell you a $300 book for every course. But we're playing by a different set of rules.
So, Terry, that kind of gives a little overview, I think, of some of the things that we're doing. I'm also trying to contribute, besides handling some of the technology, and certainly Aaron is doing quite a bit of that, too, and Dave's kind of working a little bit of the back end and helping to support the entire site. It's my goal, having just spent the last couple of years, and I've been a teacher for 10 years, I want to be able to bring to the table educational technology in getting teachers to use distant learning technology and making sure that everybody's up to speed with teaching pedagogy and you know, ways of utilizing students' strengths and weaknesses in learning and being able to use technology. As Dave was talking about, a lot of these people not only don't know about the idiosyncrasies of the bills and things like this, but we also need to teach them how to use networking capabilities and technology and setting up their organization to begin with. And so it's going to be my hope to help instructors to be able to capitalize on technology and to be able to use that in their courses and, you know, in their delivery model.
Well, with the whole distant learning thing, that's an important point to bring up. Our instructors right now, you two folks are in Michigan. Our dean of general studies and English is in South Carolina. We've got Michael Perutka and David Whitney, who happen to be in Maryland. I'm in Pennsylvania. So students can be in Bangor, Maine. If they've got access to a computer, they can find us. And even if they don't have high speed, we can deliver these things in a variety of different ways, and you're learning from home. You don't have to go to a brick-and-mortar school and pay thousands of dollars in residential fees. You know, you can take these studies on your own time. A lot of them, especially Great Books programs, lend themselves nicely to totally independent study, and you interact with the instructor either by telephone or by go-to-meeting type of conference calls where, you know, all the students can come in and we can roundtable, discuss the concepts that came up. Yeah, this summer I've been teaching a course on the federal government, and we've just got all kinds of good material coming at this because we're studying from the U.S. government manual, which is available online. You don't have to even buy it. You can get the PDF version of it if you want to, and a book that I wrote on the federal government structure. So that's downloadable for the students, and, you know, there's very minimal expenses. You can get a full bachelor's program from us for under $10,000, whereas you're about $140,000 in the average university as an average. So would you rather be, you know, $140,000 in debt before you've had your first job, or would you like to pay as you go and even come in as an adult ed student? That's something that's really amazed me. The courses that we've done so far, we've had people with master's degrees taking our 100-level courses because they realized they were shortchanged in their own academic history. And that's just, that was phenomenal for me to be teaching people that already had master's degrees coming in. I figured we'd be dealing with college students, but the people that seem to understand what it is we're saying tend to be already fairly intelligent by most modern standards. That's been quite impressive.
I have to say that I'm envious because, you know, you're providing a means of education that I never experienced throughout my, you know, first 60 years of my life. When I first heard about the Sherman Institute, I was wishing I had, you know, some time on my hands because, you know, to be able to take someone who is a true scholar, a true expert, and a proven person in their field and allow them to develop their own curriculum for a topic that no one knows better than they do, and to be able to have a personal interaction with that quality of a person in your instruction process, to me is just, I thirst for something like that, to be able to have the time to even go and do it. And I encourage everyone listening to really check this out, because it's certainly a rare situation. I mean, I envision, taking a sound money course by somebody like Larry Parks or Dr. Edwin Vieira. What could be greater than that, learning.
We use Ed Vieira's books in two of our economics courses.
Yeah.
Well, so online learning is so superior to anything that's available in a brick-and-mortar school. I think that the traditional schools, the brick-and-mortar schools, are really afraid of their online university counterparts, and many of them are expanding into online courses. And students are beginning to realize that you can do everything that you can in the brick-and-mortar school, only better. In every possible way, online learning is more interaction between the student and the teacher, particularly at Sherman Institute.
Well, this whole thing
is more flexible.
It's just amazing how this is working. If you look at the average school and the cost it takes to go there, they're charging fees that are just, you look at the list of fees that the average university charges, even if you're not part of the football program. They've just put in a new $15 million stadium, so someone's got to pay for that. And none of those costs are involved in something like Sherman Institute. So you avoid all that. The student loan crisis right now, it's nearly $1 trillion of student loan debt for people who have taken courses that, there's folks out there with master's degrees flipping burgers now because the whole economy's going south and the country is being systematically picked apart by the people we owe money to in foreign lands. I mean, they're selling bridges right now on the political level and bringing in Chinese contractors to do the work because someone's got to do something to back up all this borrowed federal money. And, there's a book on my shelf here called Twilight of the University. 20 years ago, they were talking about how this whole academic system is going to come crashing down because it hasn't delivered what it's charging for.
Gentlemen, it's not just that. I mean, everything you just said is true, but it's more than that, because our government schools have been taken over by the government and by the socialists, and they've been infiltrated as a conspiracy. It was an admitted conspiracy back in the 50s by the tax-exempt foundations that they were conspiring to take over the education system, and they effectively completed that when Carter appointed the first secretary of the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm.
So these schools are precisely what's dumbing down our young people. We've all been victims of that. And you are providing a situation where somebody can avoid that. You can avoid paying out all that money to have your kids' minds brain soiled.
Well, and that's what we're hoping. I mean, the folks that understand what it is we're saying are probably not our best target students. Folks that are in their 50s and 60s now, they may think about financing a little something for their kids or grandkids, but they're not our students. So that's our biggest problem, is getting the word out. I don't even know how to open Facebook, and most of the kids today are tweeting about where they're going to school. So we got to get some young blood involved in this loop that can help us with those areas of marketing. But beyond that, I think that's probably our greatest challenge. Finding good instructors has been pretty easy. In fact, people who are frustrated and have been tenured professors are coming our direction because they recognize, I couldn't teach the background, the backstory to Shakespeare's Hamlet when I was teaching in a public school. but I can teach about the gunpowder plot and the Jesuits and stuff like this within Sherman Institute. You know, it's a whole different ball game here. So it's really neat the way it's all playing out.
Well, and it's really neat working with these other two co-founders here that I've been working with, and just seeing how this whole thing is shaping up here, Terry. And I'm noticing that we're getting pretty close to the 2 hour limit here, but I just wanted, before we ran out of time, to just let you know how much I appreciate you bringing me on and allowing us to share both my experience in the court and this travesty that we've got with these broken courts and the Sherman Institute as well.
Well, I appreciate all of you guys, and I really am just pleased to have you on with us. I believe Red's dropped off. We're under 1 minute. Make sure everybody knows how to get information on the Sherman Institute before we close out.
Well, that's
shermaninstitute.com. Yeah, go ahead.
Two websites. Shermaninstitute.com is kind of our front line with the public. You learn about us, see some of our flyers, get to know the information there. And when ready for classes, the academic deployment website is .org. So shermaninstitute.com, shermaninstitute.org. Between the two of them, you'll figure it out in a hurry once you look around and see what's going on.
That's right.
And David, let me know. I've got a supply of Church Deceived and be glad to ship that off to you at a wholesale rate. So
that'd be great. I'll be in touch with you on that on the email then.
Super. Gentlemen, thank you very much. And on behalf of Dr. Kate and Red Beckman and Terry Dodd, have a great night. God bless. See you next week.
God bless you. Thank you.
What if his people prayed? And those who bear his name would only seek his faith, yeah, and turn from their own way. And what would happen if we prayed for those raised up to lead the way? Then maybe kids in school could pray. Unborn children see light of day. What if the light that we pursue came from a hunger for the truth? What if the family turned to Jesus, stopped asking Oprah what to do? What if his people prayed? And those who